Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we present a new show exploring some aspect of UFOs or the paranormal. And this week, the choice for my show is levitation, human levitation. Now, before I start getting into the actual show subject itself, I want to give you a little bit of the UFO news. And there is some interesting stuff going on. One thing I want to share with you is an open letter to Albert Gore written by UFO researcher Stephen Bassett. And I just found this very interesting. He wrote it on January 29th, 2007, is the day it's dated. And Stephen Bassett has been a very, very active UFO researcher, particularly politically, trying to get the government to end the cover-up, so to speak. Well, anyway, let me just read you his letter. It's a short little letter. Dear Mr. Gore, on February 25th, 2007, at the Kodak Theater in Hollywood, you will stand before a worldwide audience to accept a well-deserved Academy Award for Best Documentary. This is the documentary for the recent movie that he just put together about global warming. Now, this moment will be a hallmark in a most remarkable political story. A man comes within a few votes of being president of the United States, puts aside an enormous personal disappointment, shuns a comfortable retirement, subsumes his ego, and takes on the grueling work of raising public awareness toward a critical issue, one PowerPoint presentation at a time. An Inconvenient Truth, this is the movie, about the dangers of global warming has broken through a ridicule of curtain of misinformation and propaganda, preventing the nations and peoples of the world from properly engaging a challenging reality. It has made you a leader to which millions have turned for guidance and solutions, which you provided in your documentary, and therein lies the problem. The solutions you propose are not commensurate with either the time frame or the severity of the consequences you predict. Those frightened by these consequences are frustrated as they consider the degree of cooperation demanded by nations and institutions to address this emergency before it is too late. They consider the present state of world affairs and lose hope for a positive outcome. Many of the solutions you present are based upon existing and projected technological innovation. What if there were technology capable of dramatically advancing and accelerating this solution process, and this technology was being withheld as a government policy? Would it not be unethical to allow that to continue? Such technology does exist. It was derived from the energy and propulsion systems of crashed vehicles of extraterrestrial origin. It is sequestered in government research facilities, where it remains today hostage to a six-decade truth embargo imposed by the U.S. government on the facts surrounding an extraterrestrial presence engaging the planet Earth and the human race. It is reserved for weaponry, not for global warming response. I believe you already know this via contacts made during years of study of national security, arms control, and nuclear proliferation issues while in the Senate and from your service as an active and powerful vice president. If you are not aware of the validity behind this other inconvenient truth, ask your good friends Bill and Hillary Clinton, or President Clinton's senior policy advisor, John Podesta. Now, the letter goes on, and finally it just concludes by saying that he should tell your audience that there are powerful solutions, extraterrestrial in origin, to which they have a right to know about and to access. The auditorium will explode with a response that will astound you, a response that will expand to billions of people who must know the truth about the world in which they live in order to fix it. It will not be convenient or without risk, but it is the right thing to do. I just think that's a very brave open letter to Albert Gore by Stephen Bassett, UFO researcher, executive director of the Paradigm Research Group. And it's stating what a lot of UFO researchers already know. We have the technology to deal with this, but it's being covered up. And that's it's a amazing to me the technology that we're discovering today is actually probably 50 years behind what we actually have. Just recently, scientists at Duke University have developed an invisibility cloak. And I'm sure you all know about the Starship Enterprise, which could cloak itself, or the Klingon ships could cloak themselves. Well, now we have a device that can actually do exactly that. It is an invisibility cloak, that's what they call it. And how it works is the object actually bends electromagnetic waves so that they flow around the object like water around a rock. So none of the waves are reflected back to the observer, and the object seems invisible, but it doesn't provide complete invisibility since it still produces a small shadow that can be detected. So it's very interesting. I mean, this probably points to how some of the UFOs are able to turn invisible. At least I think it's possible. And what else is going on? Is probably the biggest story is still that UFO sighting that occurred over O'Hare Airport last year in November. Just recently, some people have reported that there are cell phone photographs that have been taken. Now, these are very controversial. They're not great photographs. Some people are calling them hoaxes, in fact. But it's interesting that this controversy won't go away, and that there's been other recent sightings. There was a sighting in Honolulu, Hawaii, off the south shore of the island. There was another sighting in North Carolina by police officers and a bunch of people. So a lot of activity is still going on. But what I really want to talk to you tonight about is levitation, human levitation. We've discussed a lot of topics on this show. I mean, everything from ghosts to UFOs, werewolves, past lives, you name it, clairvoyance, healing. But human levitation, this is a new subject. And I'm actually really, really excited about this show because I've been studying this subject for probably about 7 or 8 years or more. And I've just completed a book called Human Levitation, A True History and How-To Guide. It's by Schiffer Books. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. It's funny, when I first started doing research into human levitation, people already knew me as a UFO researcher, and I think a lot of people were more inclined to believe in UFOs and ghosts and life after death and things like this than levitation. But I asked a lot of people, and research eventually paid off, and I found several people who claimed to have levitated, and after years of research, I was able to locate no less than 350 cases of human levitation stretching back to about 2,500 years ago and continuing to the present day. So human levitation, in my opinion, is an ability that we all possess, though there is some controversy about this. Probably the very first historical reference to human levitation comes from an Indian sage named Patanjali. That's Patanjali. He's an Indian sage who lived more than 5,000 years ago, and he's actually credited with writing the Yoga Sutras, which are very well famous and is the foundation of yogic practice. And two of these sutras include instructions on how to levitate. And tonight I'm actually going to teach everyone how to levitate. There are several different methods. What's interesting about levitation is I always assumed it was a rare phenomenon that was experienced only by yogis and mediums and saints. But it turns out that it's been also experienced by housewives, businessmen, farmers, young children, and other seemingly normal people. And all the research points to the probability that all people possess this ability. What I want to do tonight is first discuss the different types of levitation, and then I'll take you through history and tell you some of the better cases of levitation and how levitation has been treated throughout history. And I also have some really exciting interviews that I want to play for you of a couple of people that I interviewed who actually claim to have flown. So it's not going to be just me talking. And if anyone wants to call in, please. It's a toll-free number, 877-876-5227. And I'd love to hear your stories if you or comments if you have any questions about this. So let's get started. Human levitation. Now, when I say human levitation, I'm not talking about stage levitation with wires or mirrors. I'm not talking about stick levitation. I'm not talking about the Indian rope trick or anything like that. I'm talking about levitation using the mind and body alone. So human levitation reaches very, very, very far back in history, and there's so many different cases that I decided I would organize them into about 7 different categories. And the first category I came up with is called ecstatic levitation. Now, this is most commonly experienced by the saints, or the very religious, and it usually involves the witness experiencing a state of divine union with God, and it usually only occurs after years of prayer and devotion to God, though it can be provoked by exposure to any type of religious paraphernalia, or even something beautiful like nature or music. But in this category, the person suddenly falls into a trance and levitates, which for approximately maybe a few minutes up to a couple of hours. And these states are usually involuntary and uncontrollable, and they are believed by the levitators to be caused by the grace of God. Now, the second category I came up with is meditative levitation. And this is most commonly experienced not by saints, but by yogis and shamans and mystics. And it's different from ecstatic levitation in that the people who levitate this way are actually trying to levitate. It's a talent that they intentionally cultivated, controlled, and developed through specific techniques, usually involving breath control, meditation, fasting, mantras, or several other methods we'll talk a little bit about later. A third category is crisis levitations, and this is very interesting because in these cases, it's reported by people, all kinds of people, regardless of age or sex or culture or spiritual development, and it occurs during a time of emergency or trauma, usually falls, where someone will, say, be walking along a path and they'll trip and they'll fall down a cliff and suddenly they'll levitate and be carried right back up, back onto the path. And there are several cases of this, which I'll talk a little bit about later. And usually they're attributed to guardian spirits or angels. Now the fourth category, probably the most common category, is mediumistic levitation. Now this occurs to all people, but usually to so-called psychic mediums. And the episodes are usually pretty brief, lasting only a few minutes. And unlike the others, it's very controllable, though that's not always the case. And it differs from meditative and levitation in that it appears to be caused by an outside force, usually spirits or ghosts, or in some cases, the devil. But this, again, all depends on what culture you come from. It's very interesting. People who levitated back in medieval times, you could either be canonized as a saint or burned at the stake as a witch. So it was a very, very delicate question for a lot of people. The fifth category is spontaneous levitation. And this category, I sort of would put it as a catch-all category to include cases that really had no obvious trigger. Usually they occur to very young children, but happen to sometimes adults, and seem to have occurred to people who are spiritual, I guess, would be the best word, the best way of putting it. A sixth category is traveling levitation or running levitation, and this is present in all different cultures, and it's also called supernatural agility. And this is a form of levitation that involves not rising upwards so much as forwards. And it's controllable, and it allows the person to travel long distances, in some cases with just a few steps, or in other cases apparently flying or basically teleporting. And the last category is sleeping levitation. This is the rarest category. probably because people are asleep when they levitate. They don't realize that they're actually levitating. So most of the people who report this are actually witnesses who have seen their loved ones or, you know, their family or friends levitating in their sleep. And it can last for hours or much seconds. We don't know a lot about it, actually, because it's so rare. But those are the seven different categories of levitation. And what's interesting is all of these categories have been experienced by all different people in all different cultures all across the world, starting in early history and reaching pretty much to the present day. So let's just start with some of the early famous cases. I would say the majority of the early levitation cases were dominated by Catholic saints. And what I find fascinating is most of these cases came from one place, namely Italy, or that area of Europe, which I don't know why that is exactly, but my guess is that this is because the Catholic Church was really alone in keeping records at that time. A lot of cultures were probably experiencing levitation, but their record-keeping wasn't great, whereas the Catholic Church, the most popular form of writing at that time was hagiography, or the lives of the saints. So there's an enormous amount of work that has been written about the saints and people in religious life leading back into history. And that's where we get a lot of our early accounts. A typical account is St. Dunstan. Now, he lived in the year 910, died in the year 988, and he was a nobleman who became a Benedictine monk and later an advisor to King Edred and the Archbishop of Canterbury, England. And as a young student, he was accused of practicing, quote, incantations, and he was expelled from school because of this. His uncle persuaded him, however, to go back to school and embrace a religious life. St. Dunstan refused, but then he was stricken with leprosy. And when he suddenly miraculously recovered, he became religious. He became a monk and then later an abbot. And eventually he became a towering figure in religious history and single-handedly revived and reformed English monasticism and changed the course of English history. Now, he was one of the first recorded saints who actually levitated, and approximately 3 days before he died, he was walking up the stairs when he turned around and told the people who were following him that he was going to die in 3 days. And at this point, he actually levitated above the ground, and 3 days later, he died exactly as he had predicted. So it's an interesting story. The stories of these saints, some of them are pretty colorful, and they're hard to believe. But as you go on in history, it becomes clear that these are actually true accounts, and they become better and better recorded. Now, not all of the early accounts came from Europe. A lot of the early accounts also came from the Far East, who were also pretty good at keeping records at this time. And a very typical account comes from a very famous Buddhist spiritual leader named Milarepa, and his is actually the first-person account. The first-hand account of someone who has levitated. And his first-hand account is actually still in print today. He lived in the year 1052. He was a very well-known Tibetan Buddhist. And, well, let me just read you a quote from Milarepa. Now, this is Milarepa talking. After further intensive practice and meditation, there began to develop in me certain powers, those of transforming myself into any shape I desired and of being able to fly through the air. At first, these powers manifested themselves only in my dreams, but as I went on, eventually I found I was able to fly in broad daylight and go where I would to meditate. I passed over a small village called Langda, where a man was plowing with his son who saw me and cried out, "Father, look at that fantastic thing! A man flying through the air." The father warned his son not to watch the so-called holy man, as he was cunning and obstinate. The son replied, "If a man can fly, obstinate or not, there is no greater spectacle than that. So look, father." Shortly after learning to levitate, Milarepa actually had to go into hiding. he said, because crowds of people were following him. As he writes in his biography, if I stayed where I was when it was known that I could fly, people would come flocking to see me work miracles, and fame and prosperity would impede any further progress. Now, it's very interesting because Milarepa is today a very, very respected spiritual leader in Tibet, in India. And he's only one of many, many cases of people who report these levitations. Now, another really interesting case is St. Catherine of Siena. She's a very influential spiritual leader who gave counsel to popes and princes and priests, and she's actually credited with helping to heal the Great Schism, which had divided the Western Church for 40 years. This is in the year, 1347 is when she was born, and she died in 1380. And this was actually during the Black Death, the bubonic plague, when it swept across Europe. And she was one of the few people who would help and care for these people. And Catherine was actually the 23rd child in her family. And at age 6, she had a vision of the Lord, she says, and just became obsessed with God. And by age 12, she had built a hermitage in her backyard. It was around that time that she started falling into ecstatic trances. And during these trances, she would actually levitate until her head would hit the ceiling. And these were witnessed by several people. And it's interesting because Catherine would actually fall into these trances, and she would start to channel, and she would give messages. And here's a message that she actually gave, which quotes the phenomena of levitation and describes how it actually takes place. So this is a quote from St. Catherine of Siena, in which she is channeling. The perfect soul lives in constant union with God. Many times the body is raised from the ground because of this perfect union that the soul has made with me, as if the body had lost its weight in order to become light. Actually, it lost none of its weight, but as the union of the soul with me is more perfect than the union between the body and the soul, the force of the spirit fixed in me raises the weight of the body from the ground. It's interesting because she was channeling as if she was channeling God, which is something that a lot of channelers do, if you're familiar with that phenomena. Another really, really interesting case, I thought, is the levitating royal family of Hungary. Usually, levitation cases are not related in any way, but in a few rare cases, they seem to run in families. And one of these exceptional cases is the levitating royal family of Hungary. For some reason, a bunch of people from this family have reported levitation events. And this starts way back in the year 978 with St. Stephen I, King of Hungary, who was really an enormously influential leader. I mean, right after he took the throne, he restricted the power of the nobles, he expanded the church, he outlawed adultery and blasphemy, he abolished pagan customs, he reduced crime, he ordered all couples outside of religious order to marry. Despite his real strictness, he was very, very generous and used to give money to the poor. And he never started a war, but he successfully repelled many, many invasions. And he was considered a hero among his people. And on several occasions, he was seen levitating inside of his tent. Usually this was right before a big battle, he would levitate. And it wasn't long before, the next levitator in this family was Ladislaw I, King of Hungary. This was in the year 1041 to 1096. And he was also a very successful leader, expanded the borders of Hungary and repelled numerous attempts at invasion. And like his predecessor, he would levitate while in prayer and meditation. And more than 100 years later, St. Elizabeth, the Princess of Hungary, she started to levitate. She had her marriage incredibly arranged at age 4. And although she married and later had children, she turned to religion and led a very ascetic life. And she gave away so much of her massive wealth away to the poor that she was actually accused of mismanaging her estate and forced to leave. And it was around this time that she started to report levitations. also numerous other people in this family have levitated throughout history, reaching up to about the year, 1298. The last one was, Blessed Helena, who reportedly levitated, and she's the seventh member of this family to do so. And so if other people in the royal family of Hungary are levitating at this point, they're not saying so. But you know what? Most of these levitation events have been covered up in history, so it wouldn't surprise me if this is going on. Okay, so let's look at another interesting case. How about Saint Bernard Raeliano? He was born in 1530, and he became a very influential Italian lawyer. And in his later years, he gained a reputation for extreme holiness, and he became sort of a counselor, and he was sought very widely for spiritual counseling. And one day, a man named Dupont, Tobias Dupont, who was a noble, went to go see St. Bernard Raeliano for advice. And while he was waiting in the lobby, Dupont saw the strange illumination coming from the door of Raeliano's chambers. He opened the door and peered inside, and to his amazement, he saw Father Raeliano hovering about 2 or 3 feet above the floor in a kneeling position, and his entire body was glowing with light. Incredibly, in about 10% of these cases, or maybe a little less, the levitators actually emit light from their body. And so later, during a church inquiry regarding the canonization of Father Raeliano, Dupont was asked to testify about what he had seen, and had he actually seen Raeliano levitate. And under oath, he testified, and I quote, "The thing was so clear, unmistakable, and real, that not only do I seem to see it still, but I am certain of it as I am speaking now, or see those around me. I noticed the light that filtered through the ajar door not one time, but 2, 3, and 4 times before this theory came to me. I wondered how there could be a fire in this room, because the rays of the light that escaped could only come from a great fire. So I stood up, and pushing open the door, I saw with my own eyes Father Bernardo Raeliano raised from the ground, as unmistakably as I now see your illustrious lordships. This that I have said is the entire truth, pure and simple, with neither exaggeration nor fiction." So as we go on in history, you'll find that we get much better documentation of this phenomena. And again, it occurs all over history. It doesn't matter where you are, what continent. There are cases that have come from there, from Australia, South America. There are many cases from North America, lots from Europe, some from Russia, from Iceland, you name it. There are some cases actually of flying witches, and it's interesting, there are about 5 cases that I located of people who used ointments, apparently, to levitate. Now, some of these ointments, the properties have been discovered to contain hallucinogenic properties. So researchers have concluded that probably some of these people were having out-of-body experiences, but in other cases, it really does seem that they actually flew. So, I don't know. I talk more about it in the book, but I really don't have time to talk about it here. What I really want to talk about next is a very interesting medieval case, which occurred to a lady named Saint Teresa of Avila. She was born in 1515, and although she lived nearly 500 years ago, she's probably one of the most famous levitators and probably one of the best recorded cases we have going today. And she became a nun at an early age, but it wasn't until she turned 40 that she seriously devoted herself to religion. And she started to just pray really, really hard. And around this time, she started to experience levitation events. While she received Holy Communion, sometimes she would rise and hover into the air. These incidents were recorded by numerous of her fellow nuns and other people who were there. For example, Sister Anne, she testified, "I was in the choir waiting for the bell to ring when our Holy Mother entered and knelt down for perhaps half a quarter of an hour. As I was looking on, she was raised about a half a yard from the ground, without her feet touching it. At this I was terrified, and she, for her part, was trembling all over. So I moved to where she was, and I put my hands under her feet, where I remained weeping for something like half an hour while the ecstasy lasted. Then suddenly she sank down and rested on her feet, and turning to me, she asked who I was and if I was there for a long time. I responded yes, and she ordered me under obedience to say nothing of what I had seen, and I have, in fact, said nothing until the present moment." So Sister Anne actually only revealed that after she was forced to by other church officials. And St. Teresa of Avila, her case is so reputable because she actually left a very, very long biographical account of what it's like to levitate. And here, I'll just give you a quote. She says, "When I tried to resist these raptures, it seemed that I was being lifted up by a force beneath my feet so powerful that I know nothing to which I can compare it. For it came with a much greater vehemence than any other spiritual experience, and I felt as if I were being ground to powder. It is a terrible struggle, and to continue it against the Lord's will avails very little, for no power can do anything against His. If we resist it out of humility, the same effects follow as if we had given it our entire consent." She goes on to say that, "I confess that in me it produced great fear, at first a terrible fear. One sees one's body being lifted up from the ground, and although the spirit draws it after itself, and if no resistance is offered, does so very gently, one does not lose consciousness. At least I myself have had sufficient to enable me to realize I was being lifted up." She says that, No means of resistance is possible. With rapture as a rule, there is no such possibility. Often it comes like a strong, swift impulse before your thought can forewarn you of it, or you can do anything to help yourself. You see and feel this cloud or this powerful eagle rising and bearing you up with it. You realize, I repeat, indeed see, that you are being carried away. You know not whither. It's very, very interesting. She gives a long, long biographical account of exactly what it's like. And we also have many, many accounts of people who saw her levitating, which makes her case just very, very reputable. Another really interesting case occurred to a Dominican nun named Maria Villani. She lived from 1584 to 1670, and she would often fall into ecstatic trances and levitate. And she also left a detailed written record of her levitations in a personal letter to a priest dated in the year 1618, which I'll give you a quote right now. "On one occasion, when I was in my cell, I was conscious of a new experience. I felt myself seized and ravished out of my senses, and that so powerfully that I found myself lifted up completely by the very soles of my feet, just as the magnet draws up a fragment of iron, but with a gentleness that was marvelous and most delightful. At first I felt much fear, but afterwards I remained in the greatest possible contentment and joy of spirit. Though I was quite beside myself, still, in spite of that, I knew that I was raised some distance above the earth, my whole body being suspended for a considerable space of time. Down to last Christmas Eve, this happened to me on 5 different occasions." So you can see that this is being reported throughout history. Another really, really famous case, probably the most famous in all of history, is St. Joseph of Cupertino. Now, he was a guy who lived in Italy in the years 1603 to 1663. He was born into poverty. His father was a carpenter, and he sold the home to pay for debts and died soon after Joseph's birth. And Joseph himself was reportedly withdrawn and excitable, dim-witted. He had a deformed foot, and he was given the nickname the Gaper because he had this slack-jawed, sort of vacant expression. And he was reportedly unable to be employed. He was fired from several jobs until he was finally apprenticed by the Franciscan monks. And it was here that his spiritual transformation just grew very quickly. He started to fall into these ecstatic trances and levitate. And over the years, the number of his levitations rose up to about 100 different levitation cases, which were witnessed by several hundred people. And the first time he levitated, and it's all very well recorded, exactly when he started levitating. The first one occurred while he was saying Mass in a monastery in Naples. He just fell into a trance and levitated from a corner of the church and flew across the room to the altar. And after that, the levitations just came fast and furious. And whenever he saw anything religious, he would levitate. A picture of the Virgin Mary, a baby lamb would send him levitating, religious music would send him levitating. Actually, at one point, he was forced to go into hiding because his levitations were attracting so many crowds of people that they had to set up temporary housing wherever St. Joseph went. He became known across Europe as the Flying Friar of Europe. And eventually, he levitated before numerous very, very high-level witnesses, including dukes and probably the most famous was Pope Urban. And Pope Urban actually witnessed the levitation and claimed to have witnessed an actual miracle. The Spanish ambassador, he witnessed the levitation. The Duke of Medina, he witnessed the levitation. Many others, the Bishop of Marcelli. He became so famous that, and he levitated actually to the day he died. On his deathbed, he was levitating, as was testified by his doctor. And all the researchers who have actually investigated his case have come away convinced that the levitations are, in fact, real. The report on his canonization is in excess of 1,000 pages. So it's really an amazing case. And I think probably one of my favorites. But there are a lot of cases. There are just so many, it's really hard for me to pick which ones to quote to you guys. I should probably talk a little bit about some of the cases in Africa, just because they're so different. In these cases, they usually involve interesting shamanistic rituals. Sometimes they're fire ceremonies, sometimes they involve mantras and chanting and things like that. One really interesting case involved two Zulu men, one who was a sorcerer and one who was a young apprentice, each standing several distant feet from each other. And this was witnessed by anthropologist Richard Hodgson, who traveled to Africa in 1893. So he watched these two men each take a rope with a stick tied to the end, and they began to spin these ropes, these devices, over their heads. And then when the two ropes started to strike against each other with a stick, and a flash of light was produced right where the sticks were hitting each other. And at this point, there was an explosion, and the young apprentice fell lifeless to the ground. So the sorcerer stepped forward, and he grabbed a handful of weeds, and he lit them, and he started passing them back and forth over the unconscious man. At this point, I'll quote Hodgson. He says, "To my great amazement, I saw this body detach slowly from the ground and float in the air at an average of 3 feet in height. It rose and fell according to the slow or rapid passes made with the burning herbs. And when the herbs were consumed by the fire and fell to the ground in ashes, the body of the young Zulu fell in turn. Some magnetic passes practiced by the sorcerer on the young man sufficed to wake him up. He stood up with the appearance of having suffered from the experience and became subdued." Another really interesting African case took place in 1984. So this stuff is, I mean, there's lots of modern cases going on. And this involved a German film crew who went to Togo, Africa to film a sorcerer named Nana Owaka, who claims to be able to levitate. So Owaka first got permission from the gods, he said, and then he found a location which he surrounded with twigs in a circle, a perfect perimeter. He then lit up this perimeter of twigs on fire so that he was standing in the middle of the circle of fire. And the German film crew was allowed to film, but was not allowed to enter into the circle of fire. And at this point, he began to meditate and sort of go into a trance, and then he levitated about 2 feet in the air for a period of about a minute. Then he slowly came back to the ground and then slowly levitated back into the air. And it took me a long time, but I actually found this film online on the internet, and it's pretty convincing. It's not a great quality of film, but it's one of the more interesting cases, I think, of levitation. There are several cases which have been filmed, and that's one of the few cases. There are cases actually across the world. I said there's cases in Siberia, there's cases in Hawaii. There was an explorer named Dušan Gerci, and he went to Haiti, and he actually observed many cases of levitation during ceremonies involving voodoo ceremonies. And he said the Hungans, or the witch doctors, were able to make people become possessed, and he make them levitate pretty easily. And he eventually observed several dozen of these cases until he was convinced enough that it no longer shocked him. He was able to carefully observe that there was, in fact, levitation going on. Now, one of my favorite cases, I think, of them all, is St. Gerard of Majella. He was a man who lived from 1726 to 1755. And he was called one of the most famous wonder workers of the 18th century, and probably one of today's most popular saints. And he lived a lifestyle of extreme asceticism, wearing heavy chains and putting bitter herbs in his food, knelt on sharp stones. But at any rate, he was credited with a huge number of miracles, including healings, prophecy, telepathy, control over nature, multiplication of food, invisibility, bilocation, and levitations. What I find so interesting about his case is that he shows that the human potential, that we really do have the ability, all these amazing abilities. Now, I noticed that we're running out of time, and I want to get to the point where I can actually describe some of the techniques to you. But I also want to play a few of the tapes. So let me just tell you a little about the tapes that I want to play for you. I interviewed a couple. This is how I got interested in levitation. I found some people who claimed to have levitated. And there was one category, spontaneous levitations, which didn't really have any cause, but I found that people often levitated between a certain age and children. And it was usually between ages like 6, maybe 4 to 6, to maybe about age 9 or 10. And why this is hard to say, I think it's probably because children haven't put limitations on themselves. And I don't know, it's difficult to say. But at any rate, I found two cases of people who levitated at this age, and I just want to play for you a little bit of the interview I did for them. Now, the quality is not great. There's a little bit of a hum, but I'm sure you'll be able to hear it, and it's very interesting. And this first interview lasts about, 3 minutes. So I'm just going to play it for you right now. I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
We rented the second floor of a duplex, and in order to get upstairs to our house, there was a long flight of stairs and then a turn with a short flight of stairs. And I can remember as a child just going up and down those stairs from time to time without running up and down. I would just, like, levitate. I would, I, I got up the stairs, and the first time I didn't know how I did it. But I knew I started out at the top, and the first time I did it, I went from the top and I was down at the bottom.
Around the corner?
I went around the corner and down. And I remember once going up that way. I called it flying. I don't remember flapping my arms or anything like that, but I do remember that I didn't use any kind of energy at all. I was transported back and forth. And it was very confusing to me, and I had a young cousin who was actually in his teens, but he was my friend, and he was the one who understood me as a child, because most everybody else treated me like a child, and I was not like a child. And I can remember telling, I remember what happened. He brought a bunch of pictures over for me to look at.
Uh-huh.
They were black and white photos, little 3x5s or something like that, that he had developed. And I don't know why he was there or why he had brought them. But I remember telling him that I could see the people in the photographs move. And I could see what they had been doing before and after the photo was snapped. And he told me, he said, come on, you're making that up. And I said, no, and I could see the people moving. And I knew what they had been doing before and after, and I told him, and he didn't say too much, but I could tell by looking at him that I was correct. And when we talked about it a little bit more, I told him that I could fly up and down the stairs, but I couldn't show him. It wouldn't happen.
Did you try to?
Mm-hmm, sure. Are you kidding? He said, show me, show me. I said, can you do it too? I thought everybody could do it. I couldn't do it for him, and it was frustrating. But he was the only one I had ever told until I grew up. And he always treated me with great regard and respect, and he never told any.
So isn't that interesting? She, as a child, she would actually fly up and down this one staircase. And what I find so fascinating about this is I found several other cases just like this. In fact, I was just recently contacted by another person who told me the exact same thing. He had a friend, his best friend, as a child, reported the same thing, that she often flew up and down her staircase. Now, here's another short little case I want to play for you, which involves, she's now a lady, but as a little girl, she levitated. And this is, again, a very short little interview that I did with her, but I think you'll find it very, very interesting.
I was, I think, 7 or 8 years old, and my parents were taking me to the doctor. And the doctor's office was in a, fairly large office building, an older building in Chicago, and we got off the floor at the doctor's office, and it was a square-shaped building, and to get to the office that I had to go to, I had to walk, 3/4 of a square all the way around to the other side. And I ran ahead of my parents, and I had a sensation of the light changing in the corridor. It wasn't a bright light, but it was more like a glowy feeling. I felt like the faster I ran, this glowy feeling around me, not myself, but in the exterior around me, intensified. And I felt my legs no longer touching the ground, but I felt that I could fly, and I looked down and I was flying. And I would say it was not, I didn't go very high because it was inside, but I was like at least 3 feet off the ground. And it lasted for about however long it took me to go around all the corner, probably about 30 seconds. And when I came to my feet, I had the sensation of being placed down as opposed to to falling or all of a sudden not flying, I felt almost placed back on the ground.
Wow.
That's what I remember.
You went around the corner?
Yeah. You know, around the corner inside the building.
Was there anyone there at the time that saw?
Nobody was there. Actually, I was ahead of my family.
Uh-huh.
And when I tried to, of course, tell them about it, they said, yeah, sure. But no one could ever talk me out of the fact that I hadn't flown because I felt I had.
Well, first I want to apologize for that high-pitched squeak, but I hope you were able to hear her testimony, at least, in which she says she flew down the hallway there on the way to the doctor's office. And it's only one of many, many testimonies I have of people who have levitated. And this stretches into modern times. I've talked to people who are levitating today, and there are actually techniques that anyone can use to levitate. And let me just tell you a little about this. Like, for example, there's a guy named Yogi Masaharu Naruse, who's one of today's leading yoga teachers. And he says it's very, very easy for anyone to levitate. All you have to do is focus on a point in front of you, above and in front of you, until you have an out-of-body experience and you actually vacate your body and occupy that point of space in front of you. And as soon as you are able to do that, your physical body will be carried up with you and follow your spirit. And I know that sounds simple, but that's basically the core technique of this. As according to my research, levitation is really, really connected to the out-of-body experience. For example, in dreams, you'll notice that everyone can fly. Everyone has the ability to fly in their dreams. And the dream state is actually a sort of inferior form of the out-of-body experience. What you are, dreams are sort of half-remembered body experiences. So what happens is that when someone is having an out-of-body experience, they're actually strengthening their astral body. And so by repeated out-of-body experiences, the strengthened astral body sort of aligns with the physical body, and the physical body becomes astralized, and it becomes what's known as the rainbow body, and it starts to actually contain the abilities that you would normally have only in the astral state, which includes levitation. Now, there are actually six different techniques that you can use to levitate, and one is called pranayama, and this is, you can get a book on this, and I don't really have enough time to go into it here because it's a very, very complicated procedure, and it should really only be used by serious yoga students who are already under the guise of a teacher. But what it does is it involves a form of breath control in which you inhale for 16 seconds, hold your breath for 64 seconds, and exhale for 32 seconds, and a sort of a pattern of a ratio of 1-4-2 for inhalation, retention, and exhalation. And it's pretty complicated and should only really be performed by people who have already mastered the various yoga asanas, including the postures and the samyamas, the meditations, and the other steps, good thought, good action, abstinence, meditation, concentration, and other things like this. But it's interesting because a lot of the methods to achieve levitation in the various cultures involve methods of breath control. And we have our own method called the finger levitation, in which a bunch of people get around a person, take a few deep breaths, and then lift them up with their finger. Well, Heward Carrington actually did a scientific experiment proving levitation is a fact using the finger levitation game. He put five people on a very large scale and had them perform the levitation game, and on each occasion they recorded a loss of weight of about 60 pounds, 40 to 60 pounds. And it was a repeatable scientific experiment that proved levitation as a fact. Patanjali, he's the guy who wrote the Yoga Sutras, and he actually calls levitation one of the seven major psychic powers of human beings. And he says it's very easy to achieve. All you have to do is follow his one sutra, which is say, which is this. It's very, very short. By knowing the relationship between the body and the ether, the yogi transforms his body and mind so that they become light as cotton fiber. He can then levitate in space. Now here's another translation, because you've got to remember this was written like 5,000 years ago. By samyama, or meditation, on the relationship between the body and space, and on the lightness of such things as cotton down, the yogi acquires passage through the sky. So basically what they're saying is you imagine yourself as being light, as being composed of space. And the truth is, the body is mostly energy. It is mostly space. There's mostly space between our molecules and atoms. So this is a meditation that I think actually works really well. I've done it myself, and once I woke up and my arms were floating up above my body, I was still on the couch, but my arms were straight up in the air, which I found fascinating. So it is a very interesting meditation. And I think that's probably the actual secret. Swami Bhakta Dishita, he says that anyone can levitate through a simple meditation. All that you have to do is shut out all external thoughts and internal thoughts and think only of that which leaves the body at the time of death. He says, focus all your mental energy inwardly on your soul, and then as you begin to realize this more and more, a veritable blaze of illumination will rise within you. And this wonderful experience, this boat bathing in the great ocean of soul force, it will develop startling powers in anyone. It is capable of charging your being with powerful energy. It will brighten your intellect, lighten your physical weight, and may even give you the power of rising into the air of levitation. Now, according to the Buddhist traditions, you can actually levitate by meditation on the third eye chakra or the heart chakra. And this is very simple to do. Just find a quiet location and clear your mind of thoughts and focus on these two areas and imagine these chakras spinning and becoming active. And what's really interesting is levitation and out-of-body experiences and all this stuff activate numerous other psychic powers, such as precognition, clairvoyance, all sorts of this stuff. So it's very, very exciting to do. Now, of course, mediumship is another method you might want to try. If you know a very good medium, that might be one method of experiencing levitation. I was able to visit a physical medium myself, and she was able to perform table lifting, and I was able to actually have her not touch the table at all, and I was able to make the table rise a little bit by myself underneath my hands. So I felt the power of this levitation myself, and I know it's real. Definitely the best method, I think, is astral travel. There's a very, very strong link between astral travel and levitation. So if you can learn to astral travel, and there's a lot of literature on this, I think that's probably your key to doing it. Willpower is another method. Several people that I've talked to and in this book have levitated purely by willpower alone. They just concentrate on rising up and feeling light. So there are a few methods there that you can use. I know this is a lot to absorb in one night, but human levitation, if I could just give you one message, is that it's a fact. It occurs across the world to all different kinds of people in all different cultures. It's an innate human talent that anybody can do, including you. And I think that actually people are much closer to being able to do levitation than they realize. If you were to devote, say, the time and energy that you devote to your job or your education at school, say, like a couple of years or maybe full-time or even part-time, a few hours each day, I think you would make amazing progress and would definitely levitate. So that's my show for tonight. I want to thank you all for listening. Human levitation. You can do it. I think you can do it. Next week, I have an amazing show. I have an abductee, a UFO abductee named Jim Sparks, who has written a book called The Keepers, An Alien Message for Humanity. And he's a conscious abductee. He actually remembers 95% of his experiences without hypnosis. So I'm really excited to talk to him. And thank you all for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and I'll hear you all next week. Good night.